Welcome to episode 92 of The Digital Life, a show about our adventures in the world of design and technology. I'm your host, John Follett, and with me is founder and co-host, Dirk Niemeyer.
Greetings, John.
So today, let's talk a little bit about the realm of bio-inspired tech. I think this is such a tremendous area. I think Bill Gates was quoted as saying something like, if he were going into tech now, he would be going into biotech because that's where all the action is. I'm paraphrasing. But bio-inspired technologies are going to be huge in the future. And, you know, even now, we're starting to see some of the fruits of that. And I know that the sort of the science, design, and engineering all come together to create some amazing things. The first item we have to talk about today is the idea of data storage. You know, we have data storage problems now, don't know where to put it all, and it's hard to keep it from going bad, frankly. But data storage in a natural repository of DNA, which I think is a fascinating use of DNA coupled with storage technology. So researchers in Zurich in Switzerland have found a way of encoding 83 kilobytes of information in a DNA strand. And apparently, if you have 1 gram of DNA, you've got 455 exabytes, or the equivalent of 455 billion gigabytes. So that's a lot of, I don't even know if you call it, you know, you can't call it hard drive space, sort of soft storage space, right? So that's a pretty amazing amount. At the same time, it's really not all that stable, right? So they have to find a way to stabilize it over time, fossilize it maybe. But when you think of, you know, a problem like data storage being solved by a all natural solution, right, like DNA, what are the thoughts that come across your mind, Dirk?
Well, I mean, it touches on so many things, right? I mean, you open the show talking about biology and the relationship with technology, and this is such a great example of that, where it's really where we're headed across many different evolutions of computing technology, not just storage, but we're going to get more and more into both integration into our biological selves, but then also getting lessons from the world of biology outside of just the human animal and incorporating those lessons as we're now able to really understand the world just with increasing crispness and clarity. You know, nature is the best technology of all. So the more that we can learn from it, the more advanced the things that we'll be able to build to extend ourselves will be. You know, the other thing I think for listeners of this show that might be sort of particularly relevant is the storage, you know, having data storage in DNA is part of what's going to be an increasingly growing trend, which is basically interfaceless experiences. So if we assume that this path of data storage, you know, storing within our own genes basically is optimal, there's no place for user experience in there. There's really no place. I mean, there will need to be a user interface, of course, but at that level, you know, it will be solved at sort of a system level of here's the interface, you know, here's the physical interface between the being and the, you know, the computing stuff that shoves the data in. So this is a whole category for which there is no need for UX. There is no need for UI, at least in the ways that we think about them, and at least in the ways that employ a whole bunch of people currently. So data storage, this is just one really good example of something that's going to be happening across a wide front, namely that we're heading towards interfaceless experiences. And, you know, that will be troubling perhaps for the many, 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 many people who are training up and getting into what is currently a very vibrant user experience job marketplace.
Yeah, I think, you know, in sort of a larger sense, there is a huge need, I think, for bio-inspired we'll call it product design, right? But it's much more than that. It's sort of what is the or what are the human aspects of, you know, any of these biotechnologies? What are the ways that relationships are managed and mitigated on the human side? Because, you know, ultimately it is data that we're going to want to store and retrieve in this particular example. So there's a read write part, a consumption part of that, you know, ultimately has to relate to the individual, whether it's via, you know, an interface as we would normally think about it, or, you know, in a larger sense of the interface, you know, maybe it's you know, how the information moves from something that we can, you know, touch and manipulate into this archival state and back again. So I do think there's tremendous need for design type thinking, but as the UX industry is framed up currently, it doesn't quite encompass that, I feel.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. You know, the questions that would still be relevant and interesting for people of, you know, perhaps the sort of background and skills that UX people have to do with systems and complexity and interrelationships. It's sort of a whole scale up and requires different types of thinking and training, perhaps, than a lot of the people currently engaged in UX have behind them.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I mean, this, you know, we talk about user experience as if it's this articulated craft that's existed for a while, but really it's this very young and malleable area where I think there's some, you know, important aspects, whether they come from sociology or ethnography or architecture or other aspects of design that have been absorbed into the general framework of user experience, which may sort of spin off again, right? So if you want to be a bio-inspired product designer, do you start with the user experience path, or do you come in via the, you know, the bench scientist, right? Are you a lab worker first, or are you a systems thinker? I don't know. I don't know where you start on that path. Certainly, I think you could start from a design perspective and get into it, but you'd have to have that scientific rigor, or at least appreciation for it.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to need to be a scientific and engineering knowledge at a level that, you know, 99% of designers do not engage with or begin with. And even if they do today, it's sort of strictly limited to computer science and often more at a scripting practical level, as opposed to the theory that is going to become more and more important as all of these sciences and technologies converge. It's interesting stuff.
Yeah, I, you know, and we can see the problems that we have currently, you know, just in training up designers for the user experience industry. There's a huge gap in the amount of designers available with the right skills to handle the digital life, right? So we can see a similar gap coming already on the biotech side. I mean, there's no doubt there's going to be, you know, need for human relationship with these technologies. So I almost wonder as if we're going to repeat the same mistakes on the education side, not preparing the designers of the future to handle these, you know, bio-inspired materials.
Well, you know, I think that the designers of the future are largely going to be scientists and engineers. They're not going to be designers. So I think it'll be very different. It'll be like going back to, you know, I guess I'm not familiar with the nitty-grittiness of computer history enough to really say this with authority, but it'll be like going back to the 1950s through 1970s in the evolution of computing technologies, where it really is, you know, the scientist, the engineer, the specialist who is sort of creating something, you know, soup to nuts with, you know, no thought even of sort of an independent outside designer. Now, I think because of what's come before, before it, the notion of design will still be in the air, and there will be a role. But I think it will be much more common where it will be someone who really groks the tech, really groks the science, the hard stuff, and is just able to bring something, at least initially, to life. Without the deep involvement of design or a designer or, you know, somebody whose role is more to transition what they do from an engineering perspective into something that's more human friendly, more usable. As the interface itself goes away and as these technologies get closer to just being sort of essentially part of us, there just isn't the same need for a design layer as we understand it today as this separate thing involving other people.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think there's, well, you know, when I see the evolution of call it the design field broadly, I feel like there's a lot of opportunities that have not yet even been identified in terms of, you know, roles to play within organizations. So, you know, from my perspective, I do think that you're correct about assuming that the engineering and technology part of it are going to play an extremely important part. I also think there's going to be a lot of hybrid roles that that we're going to see come into being over the next decade or so. For example, I'm sure that in synthetic biology, there's going to be a whole realm of software that sort of handles the manipulation of genes in the digital environment and models that prior to, you know, actual deployment on a you know, creating these artificial organisms. So I just think this opens up a lot of other categories where design could play a role, but I think technology, as you said, will also be, you know, a dominant force there.
And we'll see. I mean, actually, I think this could probably be a whole other show. But I know you've got more on our plate. We can come back to this in another week.
Sure. Yeah, I did want to mention a couple other bio-inspired products and materials that caught my eye. One in particular, there's a mollusk that has optical features in its shell that scientists are looking at to create translucent displays that would you know, essentially serve as windows or what have you in one state, and then be able to display light or, you know, digital content in another state. So imagine you're driving in your car, and when you're stopped at stopped for some reason, the windshield perhaps becomes your display momentarily, and then can become translucent again. All of this coming from the structure of this mollusk shell, which essentially allows it to reflect blue light to frighten or at least to deter predators who might want to eat it. So that's just another example, I think, of sort of deriving from the natural order this amazing possibilities, and really, you know, using nature as the R&D lab, right, for ideas about how to structure materials. So I was pretty astounded by that. The other example I wanted to highlight today was from the field of robotics, actually, receiving some bio inspiration, and that was in these tiny little swarming robots, these robot bees that are, theoretically to be used for things like disaster recovery or observation or climate mapping or traffic monitoring or wherever you would need sort of difficult to reach environments, wherever you would need the capability of sending in robots in swarms. So those are just two I think, areas. You've got your robotics, and then you've got your display technologies, which are as different as can be, but are which, you know, receiving this this bio-inspired materials and running with it, really. There's probably not going to be, you know, any aspect of our technology that isn't bio-inspired at a certain point.
Well, I don't know about that, but yeah, we talked about it earlier on the show. I mean, the amount that we're learning from the natural world. I mean, nature is the finest technology. It's the oldest technology that we're aware of, and we're learning more and more from it as our tools for understanding it get sharper and crisper. So you know, the two examples that you mentioned, they're sort of exciting and exhilarating. They're also, you know, a little bit scary, but we're just gonna have to get over it because it's coming. You know, this stuff is going to just keep coming. There's no debate. There's no sort of open conversation about whether this should be happening. It's happening, and so we just need to get ready.
Yeah, I think, you know, you've made the point. I think repeatedly about the use of drones, right, and sort of managing and regulating those and deploying them in a safe manner and all of the potential problems that result, from drones being not handled properly. Well, you know, when you've got the possibility of these robot bees swarms, right? So now you've got the same problems that you'd have with drones, but multiplied across a swarm. I think that the rapid pace of change for these technologies being discovered and deployed, it's almost impossible for us to keep up with it at a certain point.
Yeah, and the potential, the potential for really malicious action is there. You know, I think about it. There's regularly on the news, you'll have stories about, somebody's pet python got out of its cage and, attacked someone in an apartment building or what have you. And, you know, we're heading to technology where there can be, nanobots that basically are, self-ordering actors that could, climb into our bodies and kill us. Does this technology get so cheap and so accessible and so democratized that somebody could just, unleash 1,000 nanobots, in ways that would hurt us? I mean, there's people out there who do really stupid things. We've seen what people do in the United States, certainly with assault weapons. As you get these technologies that have even less accountability, that have even more abstraction from actual people. You know, you don't have to look them in the eye as you eradicate them. I mean, what are the possibilities? And I know this example might sound a little alarmist, but unchecked, and if the technologies really get to a certain point of programming and affordability, like this stuff is just in play, and it's weird. It's so different, certainly, from the sort of analog world that I grew up in the 70s and 80s. It's I don't know. It's a cool time, man.
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head there. There's this tremendous potential for doing good, and at the same time, we can't really comprehend the equal potential for doing bad things. And I think we have to hope that the technologies we're pursuing do have positive overall impact at the end. But we've talked about unintended consequences before, and I guess we can really never know for sure. On that note, listeners, remember that while you're listening to the show, you can follow along with the things we're mentioning here in real time. Just head over to thedigitallife.com, that's just one L in the digital life, and go to the page for this episode. We've included links to pretty much everything mentioned by everybody, So it's a rich information resource to take advantage of while you're listening, or afterward if you're trying to remember something that you liked. And if you want to follow us outside of the show, you can follow me on Twitter, at John Follett. That's JonFollett. And of course, the whole show is brought to you by Involution Studios, which you can check out at goinvo.com. That's GOINVO.com. Dirk?
You can follow me on Twitter, at D. Niemeyer. That's at DKNEMEYER. Or email me, Dirk@goinvo.com.
So that's it for episode 92 of The Digital Life. For Dirk Niemeyer, I'm John Follett, and we'll see you next time.